The United States does not seek a conflict. We have every hope that one can be avoided. We are, however, involved in a competition, an enduring competition that could turn into a conflict at any time. We owe it to all those who have the courage and commitment to volunteer to fight for our country and our values, to give them every advantage that they need to succeed. With that in mind, I bring us to the most pacing challenge that we have ever faced. China, China, China. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. We are out of time. We are out of time. Why do I say that? It's not that I enjoy sounding like a broken record. It's because for at least two decades, China has been building a military that is designed, purpose-built, to deter and defeat the United States if we intervene in the Western Pacific.
That was the Honorable Frank Kendall, the Secretary of the Air Force, during his opening remarks for the 2024 Air Force Association's Warfare Symposium. Many of the changes and reoptimization efforts revealed this year are occurring in an effort to prepare for a conflict with China that Kendall emphasized could begin at any time.
We can no longer regard conflict as a distant possibility or a future problem that we might have to confront. The risk of conflict is here now, and that risk will increase with time. Our job, our fundamental mission, the reason we exist, is so that we can be ready, now and always. The name of the game is deterrence, but deterrence rests on strength and the will to use it. Xi Jinping has told his military to be ready to take Taiwan by force by 2027, even if the U.S. intervenes. He recently told President Biden directly that China will, in his words, reunify Taiwan with China. He reinforced this to the Chinese people in his recent New Year's statement. He regards his word, reunification of mainland China with Taiwan, as, quote, inevitable.
What does being ready look like? What role does technology like artificial intelligence and machine learning play in helping the Air and Space Forces get there? I'm Tech Sergeant Janiqua Robinson, and this is Pushing the Envelope. From the Department of Defense's perspective, being ready aligns with the 2022 National Defense Strategy and the four top-level defense priorities the department has identified it must pursue. Number one, defending the homeland pays to the growing multi-domain threat posed by China. Number two, deterring strategic attacks against the United States, allies, and partners. Number three, deterring aggression while being prepared to prevail in conflict when necessary, prioritizing the challenge posed by China in the Indo-Pacific region and the Russia challenge in Europe. Number four, building a resilient joint force and defense ecosystem. From General David Alvin, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force's perspective, the Air Force's role in this is, quote, following through to transform the products of our operational imperatives into actual meaningful operational capability. This requires thoughtful consideration and integration with the ultimate aim of maximizing combat effectiveness, end quote. This challenges airmen at all levels to explore and integrate cutting-edge technology into our work centers while considering and mitigating operational security concerns. And all of this is at the forefront of our leadership's mind.
My name is Dr. Wanda Jones-Heath. I am the Principal Cyber Advisor for the Department of the Air Force. This job was an opportunity of a lifetime. And I say that because growing up those 30-something years, my first SES position was the Chief Information Security Officer. And so this position, it's mandated by law. So that means congressional activity and visits and conversation. And it's looking across a bigger portfolio. When you have cyber, cyberspace operations, cybersecurity, and information technology, that's huge. And so I call myself an influencer and advocate. I don't own anything specifically in this portfolio. And so I lean on my soft skills quite a bit to be able to partner and collaborate with organizations across the entire department in order to be successful, in order to be able to provide the secretary the voice from the community. I have to be active, I have to be visible, I have to be able to listen and understand and be able to articulate where the community needs to go.
In this way, Dr. Jones Heath is a bit of a bridge. She travels to various installations, learning about the successes, ideas, and concerns of airmen and guardians in the field, and brings these lessons back to the Pentagon to advise Secretary Kendall. She advocates for technology the Air and Space Forces need to invest in, and provides guidance on current trends so the department can write and implement new policies and standards to continually improve the culture for the career field and the re-optimization of the cyber portfolio.
Mindset helps develop culture, a culture of excellence, a culture of being flexible and being able to now look at what's in the cyber landscape, you know, from an industry perspective. So I would say that every airman and every guardian needs to have a technical prowess in order to make sure that we have those skills. We know that there's a talent shortage, and we're thinking about how do we take risk in building that core that we really need, understanding how artificial intelligence can change the game, understanding, you know, from a network perspective, how are we designed when we talk about things like zero trust and looking at how technology could be beneficial, but we need to do it smartly. We need to understand what it looks like, what the outcomes could be, how do we invest in it, what works for the Air and Space Forces.
Currently, there are multiple career fields under the cyberspace and communications umbrella, and they range from cyber warfare operations and space systems operations to ground radar. Each of these specialty codes plays a role in ensuring day-to-day functionality at Air and Space Force installations worldwide, and even in protecting critical infrastructure from cyber attacks.
The positions that we have in our cyber portfolio to include enterprise IT, our network, email, file share, all those matter when you look at the entire ecosystem. We need to have people doing a lot of different things. And so within our career field, we just have to balance that and use technology like AI to be a force multiplier. Use things like enterprise as a service, where we are looking at our DIP partners who are experts at running the network or managing help desks. Things like that can now free our airmen and guardians up to do the things that we need to do on mission. So we are looking at that. There was a huge initiative in 2022, our Cyber Mission Analysis Task Force, where we looked at the people side, all the things that I'm talking about from recruiting, retention, and upskilling, finding the right jobs, looking at technical tracks versus enterprise track. Not everybody wants to be an enterprise leader. Not everybody wants to be a general officer or an SES. Some people want to stay technical. As leaders, we need to understand that that is a valuable proposition when our airmen and guardians tell us that. And so by looking at that technical track, then we can have more synergy, more opportunities for those who want to stay extremely technical. We spend a lot of money on that technical expertise and building that. And so we want to take advantage of that and harness it as much as we can to do the business of the department.
The business of the Department of the Air Force is vast and complex. Implementing artificial intelligence or machine learning to protect your home computer from malware is fairly simple. You select a product or service, pay for the license, and the firewall or virtual private network runs in the background so you can watch streaming selections that aren't available in your physical region. But what's your contingency when the technology is disrupted? Do you need the same level of protection at all times, or are some times more critical than others?
Old think has been every base is equal. Everybody should have the same level of infrastructure. We want to have viable and resilient infrastructure everywhere we go. But there are missions that require a little bit more. And so now we're looking at from the mission lens. If I have a base that has a huge mission that takes a lot of compute power, then we need to think about that. We need to have various streams of infrastructure, whether it's satellite availability, whether it's our network availability, 5G, any of those types of technology that will let us move faster through connectivity. And so we're looking at all of that. And we expect that We'll have some different types of opportunities to demonstrate various infrastructure requirements require different solutions. And so there's not a one size fit all. And so we need to understand that as we are reoptimizing to be able to address our current pacing challenges, that we have to keep that in the back of our mind. We have a responsibility to the nation, right? And to our allies and to our partners. And if we're not able to generate air power, space superiority, then why are we here? We have to be understanding that sometimes technology does not work, but we also have to understand we have to have alternates. What is your primary, your alternate, your contingency, and your emergency plans? We have to think through that. And part of it is we have to exercise it like we are going to execute it. And that's another area that as we go through 2024, that I want to see more cyber infused into our big exercises, because we want to make sure people are prepared, make sure that the decisions that we're making are based on data. And so it's very important that we have that foundation built from training our people and then from exercising how we're going to actually fight.
When it comes to the fight, I mean airmen and guardians actually executing the defensive and offensive parts of the mission. What parts of the Air Force or Space Force's tactics, techniques, and procedures should be automated? Is any of this ethical, and where is the line?
My name is Lieutenant Colonel Joe Chapa, and I currently serve in the Chief Data and AI Office for the Department of the Air Force, and my role is the Chief Responsible AI Ethics Officer, or CREO. So I grew up in the Air Force as a Predator pilot. I went to pilot training, volunteered to fly the Predator, flew Predators over Iraq and Afghanistan, primarily from Nevada. And while we were doing that mission, there was this kind of robust debate taking place outside of the military on the ethics of remote warfare. And so every new book I pulled off the shelf and read, I was kind of disappointed that they didn't accurately capture the mission that we were doing. And I think theoretically they were kind of missing the mark on some of the relevant ethical discussion around remote warfare. So that really pulled me into discussions about the ethics of emerging military technology. And so from there, I was fortunate enough to be hired by the U.S. Air Force Academy to teach in the Department of Philosophy. And so that came with an opportunity to earn a master's in philosophy and really start to focus in on these questions about the ethics of applying novel technologies in the military context. And so while it started with remote warfare, I ended up learning a whole lot about artificial intelligence and specifically how ethical questions that we get out of novel developments in industry and academia, how those questions might relate to us in the profession of arms. I earned a PhD at the University of Oxford in moral philosophy, where I focused on the just war tradition and military ethics. And that was funded by the Air Force Academy, so I owe a teaching tour back at the Air Force Academy. But in the meantime, I had this intervening ops tour where I had to serve somewhere, and it was just happened to be at a similar moment where the Department of Defense was establishing its initial requirements for AI ethics within the DoD. And so the Department of the Air Force recognized that. This is kind of pre-Space Force, so the U.S. Air Force recognized that and said, we really need an ethics expert, an AI ethics expert, within the AI ecosystem in the Air Force staff. So I was able to drop into Air Force Futures and serve on the AI cross-functional team as the ethics expert. Eventually, I led that team. And then after about 2 years, we stood up the AI division in the Chief Data and AI Office, and this new role, this Chief Responsible AI Ethics Officer role. And so if we kind of rewind a bit, AI has been around since forever. And the people who are doing AI research are quick to point out to people like me that we've had AI technology in the DoD for decades. But something did happen in this century, in the last 15 years or so, that caught a lot of people's attention. And that was a transition from what some people call good old-fashioned AI, or if-then logic, or deterministic systems. And the transition was to something called deep learning, where researchers were able to use artificial neural networks stacked with multiple layers of these artificial neurons to be able to make predictions on real-world data. And so that caught people's attention starting in about 2012. There's a reason for that. There's a famous competition called ImageNet. And for the first time in 2012, the team that won, the team that produced the software system that was capable of identifying objects and images, used a deep neural net for the first time in history. And so this generated a ton of investment and a ton of energy around deep learning. But with deep learning, because we're stacking these artificial neurons into these deep neural networks, oftentimes when the algorithm produces a result, it might not be the result that the human intended. And so this drove a lot of ethics concerns on the civilian side of things. So for instance, all the headlines we've seen over the last 10 years about facial recognition systems that are biased toward light-skinned people and biased against dark-skinned people, or hiring algorithms that are biased toward men and biased away from women. All of those lessons learned started to build up an industry, and DoD saw that and thought, we really need to make sure that we head off these issues at the pass, that we prevent these issues from affecting us negatively in the DoD. So in 2020, Secretary Esper adopted DoD AI ethical principles, and very shortly thereafter, the Department of the Air Force stood up its AI division and established this new AI ethics role to try to execute some of the policy that was coming out of the Department of Defense.
As the Chief Responsible AI Ethics Officer, CHAPA helps ensure that as the Air Force makes strides to adopt and implement AI into many processes and career fields, it uses a nuanced approach and adheres to the ethical principles.
The principles as adopted are five principles within the DoD. Our AI systems need to be responsible, equitable, traceable, reliable, and governable. So responsible just means that an appropriate person at every phase of the life cycle needs to maintain responsibility for the system. Equitable means that we need to keep one eye on the biases and try to prevent some of those biases on the basis of, say, race or gender, et cetera, that we've seen in industry. Traceable is kind of leaning in the direction of what some people call explainable AI. And that principle says that we need to know, users need to know enough about what's happening under the hood to be able to make wise decisions about how to employ it. They need to be reliable in the sense that they've been tested and evaluated for the specific use case they're intended for. And then they need to be governable, meaning that we can impose the right bounds, the right guardrails, and that we have sort of a kill switch that we can always be able to sort of turn these systems off. So those were the initial principles. It's just a page long memo. But it was based on a report that the Defense Innovation Board wrote that was some 70 pages long. So there was a lot of theory that went into those five principles. And that was back in 2020. In 2022, the DoD had a working group they convened called the Responsible AI Working Council that did include representatives from the Department of the Air Force as well as all the other components in DoD. And they published a document called the Responsible AI Strategy and Implementation Pathway in the summer of 22. So that was taking those principles and kind of answering the next question down, how are we gonna do this? What policies are we gonna implement in order to make sure that we're adhering to these principles? So that document established 64 lines of effort across the Department of Defense, and we're still implementing those lines of effort to make sure we have the right policies and strategies in place to adhere to those principles that we were given back in 2020. What the DoD was thinking about was that, you know, the 10-year history of deep neural networks, where neural networks were getting pretty good at natural language processing and object classification. And what they kind of didn't anticipate was this explosion in transformer large language models. So those kind of hit the street in the fall of 2022 and then became popular with the release of ChatGPT in 2023. So now there's this explosion of interest in large language models and generative AI. And many of those models are so large and so complex that we can't possibly call it traceable in the sense that is required by the DoD AI ethical principles. So an open question we have going forward is, should we modify those DoD ethical principles in order to reflect this new capability? Or should we restrict the use of the new capability because it doesn't meet the DoD's AI ethical principles? And one possible solution to that is just to recognize that there's nuance here. Some use cases are very high risk and some are very low risk. And if we're gonna have a high risk use case, something that's gonna influence military operations or life, limb, or eyesight, or even personnel actions that are gonna affect people's careers, well then we probably need to be more restrictive. But if we're gonna use generative AI for low risk use cases, just allowing people to leverage the efficiency in back office applications that these models provide, well then maybe we don't need to hold them to the traceability standard. So it gets complicated, but one way to look at this is that there are high risk use cases and low risk use cases, and we should allow airmen and guardians to experiment to the max extent possible with low risk use cases so they can start to get the practice in, so they can start to get reps and sets and identify how these things might fail, what a failure mode looks like, how to recognize a hallucination, things like that. So eventually, I think the entire workforce will be upskilled in these tools, but only if we give them the ability to experiment at scale.
Both Dr. Jones Heath and Lieutenant Colonel CHAPA have mentioned all airmen and guardians having the skill set to implement AI and machine learning into their work centers. And we have the ethical principles to impose our left and right limits on how far the technology can go. Most of us can agree that this is an easy question to answer when we're not thinking of the implementation of the technology during critical missions. In my career field, airmen use ChatGPT to copy edit their articles or captions and even generate story ideas. But should they use it to create a press release after an aircraft mishap? Would you use it to draft a classified or secret briefing? Should more advanced tools be used in kinetic warfare or cyber warfare? And if so, what's the line they cannot cross?
If you look carefully at the way policy has developed within DoD, we started with the DoD AI ethical principles in 2020. And back then, DoD was comfortable calling them ethical principles. And then in 2022, it released the DoD Responsible AI Strategy and Implementation Pathway. So there's this pivot from talking about ethics to talking about responsible AI. And the reason for that internally is that the DoD decided that within government, sometimes when people hear ethics, they think of compliance. For instance, there's, you know, ethics rules about how expensive a lunch can be if it's provided by a contractor to a military member. That's not moral philosophy. That's not ethical theory, right? That's not solving hard problems about how do we weigh moral goods and moral harms against each other. It's just compliance with the pre-existing checklist. And what DoD wanted to signal is that the work we have to do in AI ethics is a whole lot more than just compliance with the checklist. We need to figure out what that checklist looks like. And so they moved away from ethics and moved toward responsible AI. And so now that hard work of figuring out what those policies need to be still lays ahead of us. And one of the challenges, one of the elements of pushback I get when I talk to military people across the Joint Force is that, hey, if we're gonna imbue our AI tools with ethics, whose ethics will we choose? Right? As if there's some kind of ethical pluralism that's making it difficult for us to figure out what our ethical standards are. And my response to that concern is we as a profession, as the profession of arms, we do have a stated set of moral principles. And those are the principles in the just war tradition. So when we go to war, we all agree, it's in our PME from the time that we're airmen and lieutenants all the way up, we agree that we're gonna submit to the principles of discrimination, proportionality, and necessity. We're gonna discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. We're gonna make sure that our actions are proportionate in the sense that the good to be achieved outweighs the moral costs, and we're only gonna use the harm necessary to achieve the just objective. Those are the ethical principles that sort of undergird our entire approach to warfighting. So now the question is, how do we take those principles and ensure, maybe not that they're integrated into AI, because I don't know that they can be, but at least ensure that the AI tools that we're delivering to airmen and guardians enable those human operators to submit to those principles of discrimination, proportionality, and necessity. So that makes us very, very different from our civilian counterparts, because our civilian counterparts are trying to figure out what norms and standards are appropriate in their particular industries, in the space where they're delivering capability. For us, we have a very sophisticated understanding of what the profession of arms is, and we're trying to fit our AI capability development into that understanding of what a professional warrior is, what the warrior ethos is, and again, what the just war tradition requires of us.
This is a simplified synopsis of the Law of Armed Conflict, or LOAC, which should remind us that while we're building software that will be taught to complete a task or series of tasks, no matter how complex, the technology simply won't have the same capacity as you or I. Artificial intelligence and machine learning, much like a guided missile or aircraft, is a tool which is employed or engaged as a user deems fit. The moral and ethical concerns aren't being raised solely because of how powerful the tool is, but because of what mankind has done with new tools throughout history, which Chapa explores in his book, Is Remote Warfare Moral?
Yeah, so in my work on the ethics of remote warfare, one of the challenges that kept coming up in the literature is that there was this strong assumption that said, hey, if this person, this Predator or Reaper crew or pilot is in the continental United States and they're producing lethal effects in Afghanistan, then isn't it the case that they're going to be so far removed from the decisions that they're making that they can't possibly make wise decisions? And one of the things I was trying to argue in that book is that because of the technology that allows the Predator or Reaper crew to see in real time the infrared or day TV feed of what's going on the ground, and the amount of time that that airplane is able to stay on station, actually they are very tightly looped in to what's going on in the airspace and on the ground. That's not to say they have the same perspective that, you know, an Army soldier has carrying a weapon on the ground, but they do have a very similar perspective to what their traditionally piloted aircraft brethren have in, say, an F-15 or an F-22 at altitude. And so all that was to say this judgment gap that people assume is 7,000 miles wide because I've got kinetic effects in Afghanistan, but the pilot is in the continent in the United States. Actually, that judgment gap is much, much smaller. It's more like 15,000 feet because that's the distance between the ground and the position that the pilot is sort of occupying in space, where the camera is and from where they're viewing the world. And so that argument was to say the judgment gap is not as big as we might think it is. But the way that that translates onto AI depends entirely on how we choose to employ AI. So here's two different scenarios I can imagine. I can imagine that we develop AI in things like collaborative combat aircraft or some autonomous aircraft system that's able to take human instructions from a human operator and then go employ them. If we allow our operators not just to be physically removed from the battle space, physically removed from what's going on kinetically, but also sort of causally removed, where they're delegating so much authority to the autonomous system that they don't have to take ownership for what the orders they've given entail, I think that poses some challenges. So I could imagine another way where we say, even though we have this AI-enabled capability, the human operator, the member of the profession of arms, is still tightly looped into what that system is doing on his or her behalf. And that puts that professional airman, that professional guardian, in a position to take responsibility and ownership for the even the kinetics that they might employ, and also to make sure that their human judgment is relevant in that decision. And so it's up to us, right? This is a choose your own adventure where we need to decide how we're going to employ these things. And what I would like to see is for us to ensure that human judgment plays an important role in the employment of these systems. And that reflects the DoD guidance that we've been given. DoD has a document called DoD Directive 3000.09, which governs autonomy and weapon systems. And that's precisely what it says, that we need to ensure that there's appropriate levels of human judgment throughout the employment of autonomous weapon systems.
The Air and Space Force will continue to develop guardians, airmen, software, and systems, evolving, testing, and iterating quickly to ensure that should a conflict arise, we'll be ready. This must be the reality for all of us, because ultimately, the adversary is specifically developing their technology to defeat us.
We don't know what China will do or when it will do it, but 2027 is just 3 years away. General Alvin will still be Chief of Staff of the Air Force then. General Schneider, who just took command of Pacific Air Forces, will still be in command. Freshmen at both the Air Force Academy and those entering ROTC units will be commissioned in 2027. But conflict could happen at any time, even if it is not imminent. It can happen through either intent, miscalculation, or an incident that escalates out of control. We must be as ready as we can be at all times. We need fully capable units with all the assets they need to fight China or possibly Russia on short or no notice. We need units fully ready to either deploy or conduct operations in place, also on short or no notice. We need mechanisms to ensure these units are in fact ready and address any shortfalls that may be found. We need the right mix of airmen and guardians with the skills necessary for high-end combat and to ensure technological superiority. We need organizations focused on the readiness of the current force, and we need organizations that are focused on the future and ensuring that we have enduring competitive advantages. And we need an efficient and effective pipeline of technologies flowing continuously into more competitive capabilities for our highest priority missions. In short, we need to transition to a great power competition-focused enterprise, and we need to do it now. There is no time to waste. We are going to turn this enterprise and point it directly at our most challenging threat. We are going to follow through on the decisions we are announcing today. We are going to do so with a strong sense of urgency. Change is hard. Losing is unacceptable.
This episode was written and produced by me, Tech Sergeant Janiqua Robinson. Editing and sound design were also conducted by Tech Sergeant Janiqua Robinson. Special thanks to Dr. Wanda Jones Heath, Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Chapa, and the Air Force Association. Pushing the Envelope is created by Airman Magazine and the Defense Media Activity.